Yesterday I said this in a sermon. We bring nothing to the negotiating table with God other than sin. Amazing love that he would die for me. Exodus chapter 3, please. Exodus chapter 3. Heavenly Father, I pray that you would use these truths to confirm faith in our heart. Reestablish, Lord, in our hearts who you are. In your name, amen. Today is Missions Chapel, and as is the case when I'm not able to schedule an individual who's coming through our way that is involved in missions, I'm given the opportunity to preach. And hopefully the theme would be that on missions. I must confess that you will not grasp it until the last statement. In fact, I don't intend it to be grasped as far as a missions message to the last statement. Likewise, I wrestle a lot with what to say today. In fact, this morning I shared with my first class that I reviewed 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 other sermons to see. I've got to find something different than this. Because though the message is about our God being relevant, I just didn't sense this message was relevant. And so I struggle with somehow it fitting, but follow, please, and I think that you will find a trail. Exodus chapter 3, opinion polls state that 92% of Americans believe in God. I think that's a phenomenal statement, right and or wrong. Opinion polls also state that the majority of Americans don't believe in the God of the Bible as he is presented in the Bible. I remember years ago at the second church we pastored in Michigan that I was out knocking on doors. I probably was on a bicycle, and I probably had several, some or all of my kids on the bike with me. We had five children. I made a rickshaw out of PVC pipe, and I could stuff two there and then two on the seat and then one on the tandem. And so we were probably all together. And I knocked on this door, and the lady was very gracious to me. She said, "Oh, you're out knocking on doors." She said, "I believe the Bible." She said, "In fact, I believe everything in the Bible except the stuff that Paul wrote about women. I just don't like that. And so I don't believe it." So I thought, here's a lady who states that she believes not only in the Bible, but obviously assuming that she must believe in God, but that she somehow had the authority to make and create her own God. Not allowing it to be defined by the Bible, but rather it being defined by her perception, her needs, her gender in that particular case. So I take this particular message from a chapter title of a book that I read years gone by. The book is entitled Lies About God, or 10 Lies About God, or 10 Common Lies About God. These are lies in which Satan somehow has convinced the world, and I think it's crept into the church. Lie number one is this: God is whatever I want him to be. Now, our first thought would be, I don't think that that is appropriate, that that is relevant for a subject for a Bible college chapel, because we're not the kind that somehow have infused that thought that I have the right, I have the ability, I have the inspiration to make God whatever I want him to be. Now, notice in our passage in Exodus chapter 3, we're going to take a while to build this, one major point and then two subpoints under it. Notice how that when God defines himself as to who he is, to a person who's a follower of God, God is adamant that this definition has to be accepted. Not just by Moses, but by subsequent generations, by the simple definition that is given. Exodus chapter 3, please, verse 1. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And just humanly speaking, you would think that that would draw Moses' attention. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, "I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned." And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush. I just finished talking about narratives in a class. Obviously, much more had been said than just this. I would think that God would have said, "Moses, you're about to hear a voice from this bush. It's okay." Because I would say that Moses would have jumped out of the desert without some kind of prelude to it. Verse 5. And he said, "Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover," he said, "I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have seen the affliction. And you talk about relevant. Here it is, verse 7. I have seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. Not just relevant by way of omniscience. And heard their voice or their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For I know their sorrow. And I've come down to deliver. You talk about omnipotence. I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land unto a good land and a large land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Unto the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I am capable of caring for it. Verse 11. How does this capable God define himself? And Moses said unto God, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. And Moses said unto God, behold, when I come unto the people of Israel who have not had their place of worship, their hand-me-down culture, and the children of Israel shall say unto me, the God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say, what is his name? If you were God and needed to give yourself a name that was all-encompassing, what would you name yourself? If you were God that needed to express relevancy, what name? Verse 14. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent thee. Nothing else. I am. Why that? If you're taking notes, the first major point is this, who God is, not rather who is God, but who God is. I think sometimes we approach this old study of who is God rather than who God is, as is dictated in the Bible. The background, by the way, to this is about 40 years prior to this Exodus 3 event, Moses had already attempted to take the leadership of the nation of Israel and exit them out of Egypt into the promised land. And there he tried to do it on his own strength, and God put him in the backside of the desert for 40 years. It was there that Moses' ego was dealt with, and now he comes back, and rather than him trying to establish himself as the leader, he wanted to make sure he knew who his God was. In Exodus chapter 3, verses 13 and 14, and even the emphasis of verse 15, God wants to make sure that Moses understands completely who is or who this God is. I am that I am. We know this much, that in the New Testament, when Jesus Christ used this name to describe himself or to identify himself, it was so succinct as to the deity of the Godhead that the Pharisees attempted to pick up stones and stone him. There was no doubt what this name meant. Now again, I'm going to take some time to make sure that you understand, not you, we, that we cannot have a theology where we can create our own God based upon our particular needs. Our God is relevant today. Our God is relevant tomorrow. Our God was relevant yesterday. Our God will be relevant in the future. Every generation attempts to find the relevant God, and the sad truth is this. God has always been relevant. We try to find it ourselves in our generation. You're trying to do the same thing. And in the process of chasing relevancy, we lose the identity of who God really is. And you say, well, is that big of an issue? Two huge mistakes come out of it, of which we'll draw to it. The name for God says everything we need to know about God every day of our life. And again, I'm going to say something about this God and this name for us to understand the need to have and understand this God to be relevant. The name I am simply means this. It's the active manifestation of the self-existent and thus self-sufficient God. If he's self-existent, he's self-sufficient. That means he does not need me to carry out his agenda. That also means that I do not have the right to define him whatever era in which I live. He is what he is. If my name is I am, there is nothing more relevant for all eras than that God. The self-existent, self-sufficient God, that means in the past, that means in the present, that means in the future. That means God is omnipotent today because he was omnipotent yesteryear. He's omniscient today because he was omniscient yesteryear. He's omnipresent today because he was omnipresent yesteryear. And that everything that he was yesterday and is today, he will be tomorrow. You say, Dr. Love, we know this. Moses knew this. And Moses established this with his people. And yet within the lifespan of the book of Exodus, we find two major mistakes being made in this. Let me put it this way to make sure we begin understanding the theme of this message. There never was a time, never is a time, and never will be a time that God is not God and thus relevant. Never. God expresses his relevancy to these people to the extent that God says, I know what you're going through. That means he has the ability to see, to care, to have the power to change the circumstances of mankind. Why is it that we are so easily convinced of the lie of Satan that our God is not relevant? Again, I say, it is impossible for the I am God to ever be irrelevant. He is relevant with or without my help, with or without my cultural shifts. As I was working through this, I couldn't help but thinking of an illustration. When my wife and I were here, we were married halfway through our college years, and so we ended up with a child, her senior year and my sophomore year. And this was the era where you were now allowed to go, the man was allowed to go to the birthing room to experience the birth of a child. I like to find the person, by the way, that made that rule. Because to be able to go into that hospital delivery room, the man had to go through lessons. And so now I had to become trained on how to breathe. Now, I was already 22 years old, and I thought I had it mastered down quite well. But you got into this room up at Watertown Hospital, and it was called the Lamaze approach, and you were told to breathe five times. By the way, this is a freebie. Some of you guys may want to catch on to this. It'll help the birthing process. And you were to breathe five times. Not with open mouth, you'd hyperventilate, just closed mouth, and you'd breathe five times, and then you'd rest, and then you'd breathe five times again. So when it came time to birthing the baby, here we were in the birthing room, and our baby, by the way, came rather quickly. I didn't have much time to breathe. It just, this baby just all of a sudden was there. But I had to somehow coach my wife through the breathing process, and all I could figure out was that my wife mustn't have practiced very well because there was pain in that birth, and there was none with me. So I'm assuming that somehow I'd mastered the breathing process. I might just say this, guys. I thought, wow, no problem. I might say this, guys, that your generation doesn't have to practice breathing. They've come out with these Breathe Right strips that all you have to do is on the way to the hospital, throw a bag of those Breathe Right strips and you put them on your nose and you've got it down. But as I sat in that hospital room, I realized that no matter how well I breathe, how much I breathe, how much I coach my wife was going to have that baby with or without my breathing. She did not need my help. In fact, it dawned on me while I was in there that literally billions of babies had been born without a husband's help. God does not need your help. And this morning's message, by the way, is not the issue of your relevancy. This morning's message has to do with me understanding God's relevancy. I have the unchangeable God. And this unchangeable God does not need my agenda. Does not make God more approachable with my agenda. He was God. As God as God can be before our kind ever came on planet Earth. Now, I hope that I've emphasized this enough because what happens is this. One, God, who God is rather than who is God. But when this isn't firmly understood, the second major point is this, that we sometimes think that we can change our God. There are two major mistakes that happen, and I want you to turn, please, to Exodus chapter 32. Mistake number one has to do with, I need, as I've already emphasized, I build that foundation. I need my God to be relevant. And then secondly, I need to regulate my God. I need a God that is relevant to my culture, to my generation. And I need a God then that I can regulate. I'm not speaking out of context. This is the same people group that received the commandments of Exodus chapter 3. We are not that far removed from the scene of Exodus chapter 3. What is sad is that though the time span is not long, the difference of opinion as to who their God was immense. The people who had received the notice, the title, the label, the description that God is I am are the people that built a calf. Now why? Why would you build a calf when the I am God is just right here on the mountain next to you and his presence is exhibited by smoke on the mountain? Why would you need a calf? Because they had just come from Egypt, where that calf was a relevant God. A God wherein they could practice special days to honor that God. A God that somehow exhibited things for them. And that God seemingly was very relevant to the nation of Egypt. Surely the people of Israel could somehow participate with this God, though they had the I am God. Exodus 32. And when the people saw that Moses delayed in coming down from the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods which shall go before us. Where had they been? Where were they? Who had taken them from where they had been to where they were? It's amazing how quickly the lie of Satan is listened to by people who claim God to be their leader. And Aaron said, Up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we want not what has become of him. Really? Verse 2. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And he said unto them at their hand, or received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it. By the way, fashioned, obviously, you can't just say, here's the end product. I don't know how it got here when you use the word fashioned. These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Same God, different title. You mean mankind actually thinks that he has the right to reform, refashion, rename, rebrand his God? You mean people who follow God and know the definition I am, the ever-present, always present, ever will be present, unchanging, self-sustaining, self-described? Yeah. Verse 5. And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord, all capital letters. Still the same God, but a God who was relevant. Still the same God, supposedly. Mistake number one is that when I'm not sure who my God is, I'll find a way to make my God relevant. I will easily lose sight of how relevant God already has been to me, Exodus chapter 32, verse 1, who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, and I will have the need to have a relevant God. How much more relevant can you be? Because if you were a part of Exodus 3 and are still a part of Exodus 32, that means no less than the relevancy of being firsthand witness to the 10 plagues. You saw them. It's not some ambiguous holiday to a calf. You saw your I am God walk his way through 10 plagues. You sensed it. You heard the cries of the people south of you. You worked among them. They talked about it in the shop the next day, on how real your God is. That means no less than the relevancy of being a first-hand witness to the cross of the Red Sea. That is huge. That is immense. Why would someone rename their God and try to find a God who is more relevant than what these people had seen and sensed and heard and experienced? That means up to this point, no less than being a firsthand witness to bread raining from heaven, from fresh meat falling from the skies. That means up to this point, no less than being a firsthand witness to water gushing out of the ground, a cloud of protection by daytime and a cloud of protection by nighttime. How much more relevant does our God need to be? That means up to this point, no less than being a firsthand witness to the I am God, speaking from a mount of smoke atop a mountain, who is saying, Thou shalt not. And that's where the relevancy stopped. That's where they began to say, we need a relevant God. I can't imagine an era other than the incarnation in which God was not more relevant to a people group than in the Exodus 3 through 32 segment. I grew up in an era in America that every year the auto industry had a completely redesigned car. I remember when I got married, daytime or nighttime, my wife would ask me, just teasing me, what year and what make was that car as it come ahead, nighttime or not. I could just tell because the design was so different. Every year, a new die cast. Every year, a new model. It wasn't just a paint scheme, the setting of the lights or the grill or the wheel style. It's a whole new design. And I wonder if not every generation, including mine, has felt the need to do that with their God. A new model year, a new era. And so when we lose sight of the I am God, who can never be irrelevant, I need to find a reason then for my God to be relevant to my culture. Not me. That's a whole different subject. I'm talking my God. And the truth be told is this, that if I understand and comprehend my God to always be relevant, I'm not going to be so worrisome about me being relevant. Because I'm not presenting me, I'm presenting God. So mistake number two, please go to book number three, Leviticus chapter 10. When we lose sight of who this God is, that he is always the same God, can never be irrelevant. I find myself then having the need to make my God relevant. Though my God has been very real to me and walked with me out of Egypt, through the Red Sea, into the desert, provided things for which I never thought a God could do. And now this God is actually talking to my leader, none of which the golden calf could do. But he's saying things that I'm not so sure I like. And so therefore, let me shift gears and find this more relevant God. When that is accomplished, secondly, I want to regulate who this God is. Leviticus chapter 10, verse 1. Same era, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them censers and put fire therein and put incense thereon and offered strange fire. There are books written about what it is. And I don't think that it's necessary for us to define what it is. Other than we know in chapter 10, verse 1, it's that which God did not command. We know that it's this much, that the fire came from a censer that did not exhibit the eternality of the I am God. The ever-burning fire. The symbolism that they would see, that fire never goes out, just as the I am is always with them. Verse 2, and there went out fire from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before Aaron. It was so dramatic that Moses said to the relatives of Nadab and Abihu, do not mourn the loss of these people, for they have publicly, willfully defied God. The I am ever-present God. They try to regulate their worship. Now catch this. They were the right worship leaders. They were doing the worship in the right place, the tabernacle. They were using the right means, sacrifice, in their worship experience. They were even using fire. 4 out of 5 isn't bad. But it got 2 people killed. Because somehow they thought, my God isn't relevant enough and I cannot regulate him, therefore I would like to do this. I think the storyline is simply this, that in this chapter God says, I'll reveal my glory to you. And the people of Moses did a series of things for which then God revealed his glory. And chapter 10 verse 1 opens with the word and. And I think Nadab and Abihu somehow wanted to remanufacture that glory. Redefine. Reascribe. And God says, no. You will not change the I am. I'm just throwing things out to help us understand what has happened in our culture. was God relevant before the King James Bible? Was God relevant, more relevant after the ESV? Was God relevant before, whenever it happened, Calvinism, Arminianism, worship, worship leaders, worship style, worship dress? Been there, done that. And God hasn't changed. He's still God. I've pastored long enough to look back, which means, other than heaven, there's not much more looking forward. And I've seen phase of change and change trying to find a new model year for God that would somehow be the God that the world would accept. How do you come up with a new model year for a God who never changes, for which there's no mold, for which there's no architect, engineer, designer? When God said to Moses, "Moses, I want you to understand, I am not just the God that's going to be with you for week one when you stand before Pharaoh. I'm the God that's going to be with you with week 50 when we get out of here. I will not change, Moses." You talk about the most peaceful, established hope that a believer could have is to be with the unchanging God. But once we change our God, you talk about peace being gone and stability being gone. Because now we've manufactured our own God. Though we call him capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. But it's a calf. It meets more succinctly this special need. I cannot remember where I found this pungent thought. In our approach to serve and worship the I Am God, we either clarify what we think of him through our worship of him, or we challenge what we think of him through our worship and service. That's it. In our approach to serve God or worship God, the I Am God, the unchanging God, I either clarify it, I either establish it afresh and anew over and over, or I challenge it over and over and over as to who this I Am God is. Now let's close. Why this message for Missions Chapel? Because when I lose sight of the I Am God, I will make him to be what I want him to be. One whom I think is relevant to me, and one whom I can regulate. And when we end up in the place where we have made our God to be relevant, whom we can regulate, we will not see the need to serve this God, because truthfully, we're already self-servers. Why this for a missions message? Because when I lose sight of the fact of the I Am God, and that I have the ability to somehow fashion a golden calf and still call him God, and I have the ability to take strange fire in the same worship experience and regulate that this God must accept my worship, I've made my God relevant to me. And I've established the fact that I'm now a self-server rather than a God server. Must your God meet your cultural need to be the real God? Or has your God always been who he is? Which means that today he's still that. And tomorrow he'll still be that. And if the Lord should tarry and you're given 50 years of marriage and 50 years of ministry, you can gather around a bush and say, "My God is holy. And he's the unchangeable God."